This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is the best of the Breakfast Grill, the corporate edition. Now, throughout 2019, we had many interesting conversations with corporates from fledgling Malaysian companies to Fortune 500 names. But there were four consistent themes we kept revisiting throughout the year. The first was the challenge of keeping promises, and here we mean the Pakatan Harapan government with their 60-point election manifesto. However, the challenge of keeping all these promises proved to be far more difficult and complex than expected, and one of the promises that toll roads would be abolished was one that had wider repercussions, calling into the question the rule of law. A point we asked when we spoke to the managing director of Plus Malaysia, Dato' Azman Ismail. In that interview, he said,
"What the government has done so far is undertaking a study, appoint a consultant to undertake a study about what should be the future of the toll industry be. And that study is quite an elaborate one. We have the opportunity to be engaged and to provide input, our views in terms of what the plans are. And I believe soon the government will be presenting that study to the cabinet, and obviously a decision should be made in that."
And he also highlighted the impact it might have on capital markets.
"I think the ramification is going to be quite significant because the concession agreement, as I said, was obviously made available to the bondholders for them to be able to provide us the loans, right? It is a long term. It is not a short term, tenure. Hence, the bondholders will have calculated certain risks that they are prepared to take based on the concession agreement. The sanctity of the contract is very, very crucial in this respect because it has ramification if it's not. I think more importantly as well, I think the government certainly will consider the fact that whatever they do not want to set a precedent. And then this is a situation where it's not just not wanting to set precedents, but you also want to make sure the harmony that has been created between all parties, including the bondholder, the capital market. And these are situations that we need to keep. Because we continue need to make sure that the trust level of the capital market towards what has happened so far will be intact. As I said earlier, there's a lot of ramification if indeed that decision is made."
But this has not deterred bidding from four interested parties in Plus. They include two businessmen, Tan Sri Halim Saad and Tan Sri Abu Sayyid, who are said to have close ties to our Prime Minister Tun Mahathir, a private equity fund, RRJ Capital, and even a group which is related to the maintenance of the Royal Palace, Widat Business Group. As of today, no decision has yet to be made on the fate of this very lucrative toll concessionaire. Meanwhile, another company that has been affected by the Pakatan Harapan Manifesto is Farmaniaga, because there was a promise to remove monopolies. And since this company enjoys a concession agreement to provide the logistics for drugs on the approved list, Julian Ng did ask their managing director, Dato' Fashila Emran, if their concession would be renewed. And this is what she had to say.
"As a Farmaniaga MD, I'm very confident that the government would look into extending the concession. Of course, we are very much hopeful that it will be extended anyway. And I believe that it is not based on the experiences and the track record that we are having, it is not an easy job for anybody to do it because it involves directly to the public, to the rakyat. Okay, so this is pharmaceutical industry. What we are doing under this concession, you must understand, it is not like we are a reseller that everybody is saying. We are more, I would say that we are the facilitator, because under the concession agreement, we don't have rights to choose who are the vendors. All right. It is solely the Ministry of Health. You must understand that realistically what we are doing is making sure that whatever has been directed to us is being delivered. That is number one."
But by December, the government had announced that Farmaniaga was granted an extension of this concession. Now, another major theme that was revisited throughout the year was property, or more specifically, the oversupply of it. However, this situation was not specific to Klang Valley, as Dato' Ismail Ibrahim, CEO of Iskandar Regional Development Authority, said.
But what went wrong? What has happened? It's about the matching. What that has been developed are properties that relates to the premium at the higher level, which is beyond the means and affordability of those people who are really in need. And it makes sense, therefore, for developers to take a look again at the types of houses they build to make sure that these houses are really for those that are really in need. We are now working with some of developers to see how they can break down the size of their units. Because at this moment, because the units are too big in terms of size, maybe they can make two instead of one, and therefore they are able to offer at a price that are reasonable and affordable by the institution. Secondly, is maybe to review some of the policies of the government that relates to housing.
But we ask, was the entire property market in the doldrums? Were there still pockets of demand? Sharit Abdullah spoke to Tan Sri Lim Hock San, Group Managing Director of LBS Bina, and asked if affordable housing was the segment to be in. And this is what Tan Sri had to say.
Yeah, there will be many developers because they want to come in to do the affordable range of houses. But this one had to depend on the location.
Tan Sri Lim Hock San went on to explain that for a developer, cash flow was critical, and despite the lower margins from affordable housing, at least it was selling, unlike high-end property.
For us to sell a house above 1 million, it's not easy to sell. So for those who say, I'm saying that we are doing the high-end, that if, say, for example, you have 70% sold off, even with a decent margin, say, for example, the 30% will be your holding costs. So for us who do all this affordable range, that most of the time we have 90%, 100% sold off. So even with the margin lower than this or the higher margin from their doing high end, I think that one is better off so that you don't have the holding cost. This is what I can mean for that.
Jeffrey Chu, Group CEO of Paramount Corp, also weighed in on why it was important for the government to build affordable houses and how private companies can partner with them to achieve that goal.
You also got to take care of the B40 in every country. You cannot just appease the top 20%. So in the B40 segment, you need to actually provide maybe land at a cheaper. And government, state government has a lot of land. And government can, state government and federal government can work together in terms of keeping the land at a more affordable price. And also, if they build it in mass, they can actually get a lower construction cost. So in a way, the government strategy is a different ballgame, but they need to play their part. And the government is doing it, which is great. So we will play our part in terms of market-driven products where we will have the segment that is wanting a 400,000, 500,000 better quality, better location.
A third theme that was constantly revisited on the breakfast grill was structural decline. An example of this is the media sector, where disruption has pushed some companies into downsizing and even foreclosure. Utusan Malaysia, the oldest Malay newspaper in the country, suffered such a fate after 80 years of circulation. Meanwhile, Media Prima also announced a retrenchment exercise involving more than 500 staff at the NSTP, as the company lost 79 million ringgit in the first 9 months of this year. Weak circulation and declining advertising revenue being lost to social media were factors cited for the losses. A fate shared with the company's television arm, as acknowledged by Johan Ishak, CEO of Media Prima TV, who said,
"So we realize that the revenue from the traditional side isn't going to increase. It's worsened. TV that used to earn almost 900 million, actually more than 900 million advertising revenue, has seen half of that gone to mainly Facebook and Google, right? So it's gone down to about 500 million.
Now, another business which has faced structural decline has been retail, as e-commerce has changed the playing field for brick-and-mortar shops, with departmental stores taking the brunt of the shift in consumer spending. In the US, luxury departmental store Barney's has closed down, while even global fashion brands like J.Crew and Gap struggle to gain traction with younger, more fickle buyers. In Malaysia, longtime retail player Aeon has also faced tough times and has had to adapt. This is what Mr. Po Ying Lu, executive director of the company, had to say.
Yeah, true. The departmental stores would also actually evolve with time, with the change in this consumer behavior. And if you look at Yon, we have actually done our part in actually trying to refurbish our store. If you look at our Mid-Valley stores, you look at our stores in Queensway and Bana Sunway, and most recently in this Bana Utama, as well as Taman Maluri. We have taken the initiative and efforts to actually refurbish the stores to provide a much more better shopping experience for our customers. Like you said, that the it's no longer a big space filled with products, and that's just it. You got to have merchandise assortments and categories that can actually appeal to the current lifestyles of the consumers.
Up next, the final team that has affected both local and global corporates, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to the Best of the Breakfast Grill, the 2019 Corporate Edition. Just a few moments ago, we discussed the challenge of keeping promises, the oversupply of property, and whether it is possible to overcome structural decline. Now, a final theme that was revisited constantly on the Breakfast Grill is disruption. It appeared that no industry was spared, with even global insurance companies trying to maintain their market share and dominance. So I asked Michael Wells, CEO of Prudential PLC, on how he planned to fend off the disruptors, especially the unexpected ones. This is what he had to say.
And let's talk about digital distribution, like you said, about China. For sure, I mean, you're well known globally, 600,000 agents, you know, but digital disruption is real, right? And in China, what interests me is the likes of Tencent and Alibaba joining the insurance bandwagon. So you have like Ant Financial, which is the financial arm of Alibaba. They're offering health insurance for very little, and Jack Ma has reached Ant funding. So how do you compete with these non-traditional insurance disruptors? So not the likes of your robo-advisors, but guys like Tencent and Alibaba, who have accumulated all this data.
So remember, insurance sort of started the big data models, right? Our actuarial models are stochastic in nature. We run hundreds of millions of iterations. So I always tease friends in tech that big data is nothing new to us. You know, the actuaries have been doing this for a long time. Clearly, the tools are more sophisticated. The speed of the processing, the models. We use all current, you know, AI and all the various technology you'd think we'd use to improve the efficiency of the models. But it isn't a new concept for us. So data has certain advantages in pricing of certain products. But if you think about guarantees on health, and like, there's not a no one's discovering a secret that, you know, that isn't available on your life expectancy and things. We see all of that information on pricing, and there's some really innovative things going on, but it's all over the world. It's not just in China. Where China has an advantage in insurance is you've seen very good technology come out of China. So this is one where they lead on IT. But again, IT tech is replicated, right? So this is the kind of thing that those are very difficult leads to maintain. It's very expensive to maintain. So we have a lot of that technology, you know, across the region, some from Chinese partners, right? There's no, and that's a very common model. So how do you compete with those firms? You build good products, you have a good brand, you have good people in the field, you have good bank partners that distribute. The same way you would compete in Malaysia or in Indonesia or Singapore or the U.S. It's there's plenty of market share. There's structural demand in these markets. Good competitors make you better. So we're here launching Pulse, right? So this is a public-private partnership with the government. It's a health ecosystem that's free to all Malaysians, that's end-to-end. It's got the ability to do everything from help you with your well-being and diagnostics concerns, dengue fever mapping. And like, one of our partners with that is Starbucks. If you go into a Starbucks, they're going to ask you if you have Pulse, and if you do, you get a discount and you get a credit. So these relationships are changing. So if you said to me, who wins in insurance? It's firms that can partner effectively with startup technology firms, with big technology firms.
So digital will continue to be a focus for Prudential Group, right, in terms of distribution also?
It's a prerequisite now for any financial service company to be able to service your consumers, interact with them the way they want to be serviced.
However, some other players have decided that if you can't beat them, you might as well join them. So be an innovator rather than allow the disruptor to take your market share. An approach that one of Canada's largest financial companies, Sun Life Financial, has taken. This is what President and CEO Dean Corner told us when I asked him about why the company was also an incubator. And I did notice some unusual data partnerships. And even what's more interesting is your investment in fintech businesses. You spent about $100 million Canadian in startups, right? Is that how you're actually preparing yourselves for, let's face it, the eventual disruption to the insurance industry? Is that enough?
That's one of the ways. Importantly, in addition to that, we have seeded a number of experiments, I'd call them, within the company. So they're not outside fintechs, they're within the company, where we take a team of people out of their regular day operations, might be 30 people, with some data scientists and fintech, internal fintech people, and we're building new models, new businesses inside Sun Life to see what can happen and try to stand them up and make them successful. So we've got these outside investments that you talked about. We have incubating these things internal to the company. And, you know, some of them are very promising. Some of them haven't worked, so we shut them down. So that's the nature of experimentation.
Yeah, so you do see disruptors as a real challenge then. Do you, like, InsurTech, is that a real challenge? Especially when I look at the still existing complexity of traditional insurance companies and the policies, right? So you have these InsurTech guys who are moving away from that. They're like just selling products that only perhaps you need, not wrapped with other products. Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting. If you had asked me that question 2 years ago, and I think most CEOs would have been very concerned about all these fintech upstarts. Today, it feels like a different proposition. It feels like the value of incumbency, of being in the business with a lot of existing clients, is very valuable. What we've observed is that a lot of these fintech startups, really smart people, clever idea, unfortunately, a number of them are going to run out of cash long before they get enough clients to make a viable business. And what we're doing is partnering with them. In some cases, you know, Maxwell Health's a good example, partnered with them, took a small ownership stake, ended up buying them because they weren't going to be viable as a standalone. And I think you're going to see that across a number of small fintechs. Yeah, so I think that those are actually the bigger challengers, I think, to the insurance industry. It's Google, it's Facebook, it's Amazon, it's Baidu, it's Tencent. It's these guys who have gigantic pools of data and good brand presence.
And the money.
And so the way we're competing with the likes of those guys is trying to build out our own data-driven models so that we can be there proactively, predictively with clients. Because what we've discovered is people will do a lot of research on the internet, on mobile. Buying more complicated insurance products, you want to talk to somebody.
You still need a financial advisor.
You still need an advisor. Because it's a big decision, you know, and you're trying to do the right thing for a long time and you want to make sure you're thinking about all the right things.
But not all disruptors turn out to be the unicorns that they were touted to be. Both Uber and Lyft listed this year, and currently both are trading below their IPO prices. So perhaps there was really too much hype for companies that hadn't made a single cent of profit and didn't look like their goal was achievable anytime soon. Something that the public market had less patience with than the private equity funds. Now, a question we posed to disruptor iFlix, the streaming services company which started the cord-cutting trend in Malaysia, I asked their CEO, Mark Britt, how soon can they turn a profit after burning through $350 million cash? And here is what he had to say. And since we are talking about money and finances, right, let me guess, you aren't profitable. Are you even breaking even at the operating level? Because you've just completed one round of funding. You don't specify the size secured, but I get it's more than US $50 million. Mm. Now, is that a lifeline for you? Because you spent your $350 million that you've raised since your startup in 2015?
The wonderful thing about the entertainment and content business is that you get the opportunity to invest in creating extraordinary local TV. The horrible thing about the entertainment business is it's a capital-intensive business.
Yes, and we've seen some OTTs fail. I mean, the burn rate is incredible. Yeah.
So when iFlix started, there were over 30 competitors in Southeast Asia, probably 100 globally. iFlix is now actually the only independent OTT business other than Netflix in the world. And so we're proud of that, but it's also just realistic, which is it's hard. And we like that because it's an enormous barrier to entry. You know, there's 5 years and hundreds of millions of dollars in learnings, in mistakes, in optimization, and all of those things actually create a tremendous barrier to entry. So if you're even an Astro with all their resources and all their talent, it's a super hard business to get into at this point.
So when do you think you can eventually break even, if you had to estimate in what year?
Yeah, so we don't. We certainly don't do it on radio.
We also asked another disruptor, the car sharing company SoCar, on how soon can they make a profit before the money runs out. This is what Leong Fong, their CEO, had to say.
Well, if we decided to stop investing in marketing tomorrow.
Tomorrow. But you already said you're going to spend $100 million with 3,000 cars depreciating on your books. So, you know, how soon can this be achieved?
Well, I think we have a long-term plan, as I mentioned, together with our shareholders. I think very often with any business, we look at least a five-year time horizon before we look at building a story which allows us to explore the public market option. So we're looking at 2023.
Okay. And when it comes to startups, right, the million-dollar question is the burn rate, right? So,
Yes. Like
you say, you're looking to turn a profit to 2023. You have all the financing in place for you to survive till then?
Yeah. So, like I said, I think instead of talking about burn rate, let's talk about how long can the business survive for at this current rate of burn. And we always make sure that we have enough in the bank for at least 2 years.
So the million or billion-dollar question we will continue to ask disruptors is, what is their end game? Because the supply of money is never infinite. And then what happens if the disruptor hasn't tapped the public market or done a merger or acquisition? That's all the time we have for today, but you can catch all these conversations in full on the BFM app or on Spotify. And do listen to us on The Breakfast Grill in 2020, when we will bring you new interesting conversations with the movers and shakers of the corporate world. I'm Wong Xiaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.